But we never really did the Christian circuit because we were hardcore drinkers and partiers. You know, we dropped F-bombs on stage. I would come out and do beer bongs and smoke cigarettes and then have no problem talking about Jesus after that.
You're right, right.
That's how I grew up, man. I grew up in the South. And we had a very simple phrase, a beer and a Bible are hand in hand. Cover up with makeup in the mirror. Tell yourself it's never gonna happen again. You cry alone.
Welcome back to Labeled. I'm your host, Matt Carter, and today we've got a terrific conversation with Ronnie Winter of the Red Jumpsuit Apparatus. I've known Ronnie for a very long time, and he's one of the most dynamic individuals I've ever encountered, both in the moment and across time. He's in touch with the fact that he's a unique individual, and he processes the world in a very bold and direct way that have led to all kinds of interesting, good and bad situations and outcomes. And I think that you'll get the feel for what he's like in this conversation. Now, Red Jumpsuit was never labeled as a Christian band, but they were harnessing a lot of the power that comes from Christian faith and the associated themes that have the capacity to really intensify the emotional connection in music when it's layered in there. And Red Jumpsuit came up right in the pocket of time where the mainstream was taking notice of what our scene was up to, and Ronnie was able to break in and ride that wave and create opportunity for himself in a way that only he could. Their debut album, Don't You Fake It, was released in the middle of 2006 on Virgin Records, and it was certified gold by November of that same year. Both the band and Ronnie personally have had many chapters since then, but they've never stopped doing what they do and continue to have new life and new opportunity, including the upcoming set of Is For Lovers festivals this summer, along with a bunch of other familiar artists to our scene. Now, if you have not already done so, please join the Labeled Facebook group. It's easy to find, it's a healthy place to be, and it helps guide the show and the conversations that we have here. So thank you guys. Been really enjoying this podcast. It's going really well. And extra special thank you to the people out there who are, you know, sharing it, doing the word of mouth, telling people that it's a cool thing. And, you know, it's just that there's some interesting stuff about our scene over time, currently, and probably in the future, in my opinion. So thank you guys for the word of mouth and all the support that you give this podcast. All right, let's do it. I was thinking it might be good to just get your head in the space where we're connected. If we go really far back, because I bet a lot of the listeners that are Emory fans and Red Jumpsuit fans probably also shared an experience with us, probably in whatever year it was. But I just want you to jog your memory to the Take Action tour that we did together. That was back in the time when we were doing these really long tours. And that one probably, I remember that one being long. I don't remember exactly what year or how long it was, but I just want you to put your mind there and see what comes out. We'll jump in. Then we'll jump all over your career because there's a lot of fascinating things. But if you want to, take me back to that time and tell me what you remember about that particular snapshot.
Wow, yeah, we are going back. So that would be when I first met you guys. So for the first it was cool because we were really into what we call the tooth and nail era, and all bands encompassing, whether they were on that label or not. There was just like, we didn't even really know who was signed to who, but we kind of just, I was just really into everything that was considered aggressive and progressive with spiritual undertones. So I was very familiar with you guys, Under Oath, Emberlin, you know, just Slick Shoes, just every band out there that was not afraid to be edgy, but still have some kind of belief system as opposed to just agnosticism, which, you know, just as it, so when I met you guys, that was my kind of exposure to your music. It was in that realm. MXPX, even at the time, was looked at that way. And over the years, we've all kind of grown in and out and back into it and out of it and out of it. But still, to me, it's the scariest and the edgiest thing is to claim anything, you know, so young and so early. So I really respected you guys. So when we joined that tour, it was you guys, us, Scary Kids, Scaring Kids, and a band called Cadus Fly. And they were very interesting as well. They actually had plants. That one of their instruments had a live actual plant with some kind of a tube running through it and the microphone running through that. And so it was definitely just a wild tour. And for us, if I remember, I'm pretty sure we headlined that one. We felt like you guys should have been headlining. So that was our first instinct. We're like, oh, like, I'm not really sure why we're playing last, or if not you, then Scary Kids, because both bands had been out longer than we had. We definitely were not overnight success by any means. We had put a lot of time on the road in, but we didn't really feel like we had earned the headliner of the Take Action tour, because we had heard of My Chemical Romance headlined it a year or two before the year we did it together. So we just felt like we were more of a main support act, but we accepted, you know, what the agents presented us, and we were just stoked. You know, we knew we were on a bill with bands who had songs that people knew, and that was really important to us, because for a long time it was just us and local openers.
Mm-hmm. I remember that time, and certainly you guys should have been the headliner. I mean, it was definitely, you guys had, maybe it was you had just arrived at that point, but it, but there definitely was a suddenness to it. Like you had been around and doing things, but that was at the time when you had your most rapid, you know, acceleration to that point. But it was certainly the case that I made a great tour to have Scary Kids and us on it. But I mean, we understood very clearly that we were lucky to have that opportunity and be in a direct support position to you, because what you had done is like reach a level for that style of music. You know, you were taking it to another level. Those venues were bigger than we played, and then we headlined and stuff like that. And then, you know, you guys had it. So it must have been kind of a rapid transition to that. Because, I mean, those places were 1,000 people a night, you know.
Well, that was our first time, though. So, like, before that, it was very much what you're describing. So even when Face Down was popping on the radio, we were doing the local underground circuit. You know, there were these big radio shows. We played a lot of radio festivals, which is essentially any band who has a song that's charting. But anytime we played headlining, we weren't playing those rooms. So that tour was our first experience as well, being in rooms like that. And like I said, I don't know. You know, all I can do is tell the truth. We just respected you guys, and we're happy to be there. But at first felt, you know, you guys made us feel at home right away. And but we had been listening to you for a while. It wasn't like, you know, oh, we're going on tour with these guys, let's listen to the music real quick and get to know them. So it was just cool. It was really cool for us. And like I said, most of the time when we were doing the underground circuit before Take Action Tour, after Take Action Tour, we remained in those venues. So that, I guess that was kind of like really the peak. I mean, if looking back now, that was the highest and longest we stayed at the height of our career. So that was all really kind of a special time. But before that, it was just the underground circuit with local acts only. It was just us and 17 local bands every night.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that you hit on just already is that there's something special, clearly to me, about this style of music that's aggressive, and then when it has a layer of spirituality or belief, there's a boldness to that, because a lot of times that layer has been looked at as like watering down or copycat of, like, sometimes Christian music or whatever can be looked at as like lesser than. But there was this time, and that's one of the things that you guys, you know, one of the unique achievements, I think, of Red Jumpsuit is you both had, like, when you say radio, I don't know anything about radio. I've never been on the radio, but you were able to have this come from an underground scene, have the style of music that was really real and aggressive there, put extra meaning layers really into it, from faith and spirituality to, you know, cultural issues, and put that in the music and have that then also poke through all the way to radio and mainstream. So you are part of the validation of that style of music and taking it to next level. So I think, like, in your whole legacy of all the things you've done, I think that's part of the story that really, that makes me just really appreciate that, that there's this underground thing that got bigger and bigger and kept poking to higher and higher levels, to where it belongs on the Warped Tour, it belongs on the radio. It, you know, it's in, you know, Under Oath obviously, you know, did that still first, but there's like, wait, they're a Christian band or something, but they're better than regular bands, like not worse than, and they're doing, and the sound is unique, and there's the emo-ness to it, or whatever, the language, you know, gets squirrely. It's not really all about the labeling it, but there's a kindred spirit there that you guys were able to do that. And part of it must have been, no, just tell me more about that. What is that? What is that that makes that the difference in that style of music and adding that layer? I like that you brought that up. I'm curious, more thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, we, you know, that's the
boldness.
I think it was the spiritual undertones, like I mentioned. Like, so we never really did the Christian circuit because we were hardcore drinkers and partiers. You know, we dropped F-bombs on stage. I would come out and do beer bongs and smoke cigarettes and then have no problem talking about Jesus after that.
Yeah, right, right.
Because that's how I grew up, man. I grew up in the South. And we had a very simple phrase, a beer and a Bible are hand in hand. You know, that's how we looked at it. So there was a difference between the Under Oaths and bands like my band. But the similarity was that we just accepted that there was something greater than us out there. You know, that there is some kind of loving force behind what we're going through down here. And that everything matters. You know, people don't just suffer and die alone, that there's somebody there with you through the good and through the bad. So, and you can hear those lyrics in the album. But were we role models or were we a Christian band? Absolutely not. And any youth pastor would be like, no, stay away from Red Jumpsuit Apparatus. They're not for you. And many times we would encounter youth pastors telling people to stay away from our band because we were false Christians and we were. And this is right off the rip, man. This is at the beginning of our career. And I just said, whatever, screw them. You know what I mean? Like, because we weren't carrying that banner anyway. But we did tour with those bands and we were part of that world as far as our message goes, which I think is more important than being accepted by a community. You know, it's just right. What's important is trying to help kids. You know, I was a very emotionally turmoiled young man and, lots of suicidal thoughts and like I said, drug and alcohol abuse was in my daily life. And I wrote about it. I put it right in my songs. And I talked about it on stage. And as a matter of fact, the tour that you're referencing, it was about mental health awareness back in 2007 when nobody was talking about it. Here's Emery, Red Jumpsuit, and Scary Kids saying, hey guys, it's okay not to be okay. You know, hey, if you feel like crap today and you're thinking about killing yourself, don't do it, because I feel the same way and I'm in a band. So if it can happen to me and I have everything that I've ever dreamed of, then it can damn sure happen to you. You know, when you got nothing going on in your life. So I think that was the other special thing about that tour was I can't recall before that tour, mental health being such an in your face message of a tour. Cause even the Take Action tours before that one, they were all themed slightly different. So this was the first one that was like, listen, we're going to talk about suicide and we're going to get real about it. And we did it nightly on stage. And each singer and bandmates took moments on the mic to reach out to the kids. It was beyond church. It was something else. And I held that with me my entire career. I never really let that go. I think that really set a precedent for my band to be honest and open and just always to stay transparent with our fans through the good and through the bad. And through that time, I really do believe we might've saved some lives together.
So that's just such a rich thing because again, you were not presenting as a Christian band. I was surprised. I was surprised by a lot of things. I was surprised by how wild you were in that sense that you describe, and that your spirituality was very clear and present and intermixed. And you weren't presented from the Christian container. So it made it even, you had even more flexibility and acceptance on one side, and you were bringing that thing that it's like, in a way, it's like under the radar of like the industry and the stigmas and the labels. But when you're talking about real issues and genuinely connecting out to the fans, and you're writing it in the lyrics, when they're listening to it over and over, they get it, they're feeling it, they're connecting to it. So it's like this under the radar way, but it intensifies the art itself. But yet it was not in the overt container of we're a Christian band, and you weren't even trying to be. But and so that was like that was a part of it was an advancement of maybe some of the things that were driving a lot of the bands in the scene at that time. And you Take Action Tour, that's something like it's all this related, connected mental health. It's just this new, it's a something younger and new that wasn't really as present in music, especially punk music, because it's like, yeah, it's maybe atheistic or whatever, more just secularness to it, or just it's kind of more one-dimensionally just dark or heavy. And now there's this complexity that is now becomes part of it. And so that just is super cool, but also really complicated and probably led to a lot. Like, there's just a lot of crazy stuff that happens in the intervening years, I guess, as a result. But how about the experience you had of getting noticed and getting in the major label and the radio? How did you get from underground to into that level that leapfrogged over the indie labels and stuff like that? How did that path emerge for y'all?
Thank you for asking. You know, we took a very like strategic route because this is not our first band. And a lot of times kids still to this day, I mean, I'm 40 years old. Kids still to this day ask me, how did you do it? You know, because we are a real band that was not put together by a label, that was not assembled by a management company, that was all kids from a similar hometown. And most of us went to high school together, and we were on our third lineup before we even, you know, took our first real photo shoot. And we were the epitome of every garage band that's ever existed. We shouldn't have made it. But the reason why we did is because it wasn't our first band. My first band, me and Randy plays guitar with me still to this day. And he was on the big album, Don't You Fake It. Randy's on keyboards, synthesizers, and electronics. He just didn't tour with me yet because he had his own band called Veronica's Veil. And that's a whole nother story. Eventually, that band ran its course, and then he jumped on guitar in this band. But he was in the studio, and he's credited on the album for our debut album, the one that we were touring on that album cycle. So it was actually weird for me not to have him on the road, even though he was there, you know, when we made the album. So essentially, him and I sat down, and we just looked at all the bands that made it. I mean, the internet was brand new. So we're sitting here, you know, this is in the AOL.com days, and we're looking up, how do you make it as a band? And we're just looking at it, you know, like, okay, you have to find a manager. You got to find a touring agent. You have to get a record deal, which means you need to impress an A&R. How do you do that? And, you know, we're just reading all these like wannabe really early tutorials by people who don't even know how to make a tutorial. So really it was essentially people sharing their experience. So it was better than today. Like today you see like, hey, you want 500,000 Spotify plays? I could teach you how to do it. You want to blow up on YouTube? I could teach you how to do it. It wasn't like that. It was people just saying online with script only, you know, there was no pictures and logos or video. Here's what I did. And we were finding all these blogs, if you will. This is back in like, you know, 2000, 2001, of bands who at least had figured out how to share their story online. And we were reading them over and over again. And one of the things that we noticed right away was own your hometown. So we made sure to do that. And how we did that was we became friends with a local CD printing company called S&J CD. And we went in there and they also had a studio. So we took all of our money and we put it into our first little terrible 3-song demo. And then we spent all the rest of the money that we made when we finally did play a first show on like thousands of CDs. I think our first order was 3,000 3-song CDs. And then we just plastered the next show date with a silkscreen printer on the actual CD, and we hit the town. We went to the Gainesville College campus. We went to the University of North Florida campus. We literally walked down the beach at Jack's Beach and had headphones and a CD player and would play the music for people and then sell them a CD for $1. And if they didn't have a dollar, we'd give it to them for free. And the only reason why we asked for a dollar is because we wanted Taco Bell. And we literally told them that. We're like, hey, we got to sell at least 12 more or we can't eat today. And some guy would throw us a five. And then we'd be like, good, all right, the rest of the CDs are free today. And we were just honest to the craft. You know, like, we just continued to dump every single dollar that we had into the music itself because streaming wasn't out yet. People were still rocking CD players. Literally Sony Walkmans with bass boost, you know. And we had one on us, multiple. We had three, you know, and three sets of headphones. And, you know, we were essentially like hip-hop hustlers because the people that we saw made it truly were mainly hip-hop people. And we were reading their blogs and seeing how they did it. So how we owned our hometown was we flooded the market with our music. No cover songs was the second thing that we read. Do not cover any bands in the beginning of your career. So we didn't. And every single band that we played with, it was all covers in their set. I mean, and then they'd be like, oh, well, here's an original. And then it always sounded terrible. It was like, geez, that's just not good at all. But then when they would play the cover song, it would sound spot on, you know. So we never really understood that phenomenon. So we just stayed away from it. We only played originals. We refused to play covers. We didn't play a cover song in this band until our second or third actual full-length album came out. And then we finally did it. We did one, like, weird AOL sessions that the label asked us to do. So we picked a four-chord song real quick that was literally four chords, and I kind of knew the lyrics. And it was more like a karaoke live session than an actual we're covering the song. So, you know, that was the second thing that we did. And the third thing that we did is we established a real street team. That was the thing that we read. So we became really good friends with this core group of like 25 to 30 kids. We divided them into sections around the town, and we would distribute to them these flyers and these CDs with the show dates on them. Then what we did is every single time a band came that was metal, punk, ska, post-hardcore, or grunge, or anything like that, we would go to that show. We would go to the parking lot, lift up the windshield wiper, turn the CD face forward, put it down and do that, and go all the way down each row of each car. Well, next thing you know, Lex and Terry, the radio station, they got one of our CDs. They heard it somehow, some way, because we're just flooding them everywhere. And then also when we went to the college campuses, we went to the dorms and we slid the CDs underneath the door, or we slid the door jam. We actually did these things. This is 100% true story. I have many people who are like, oh yeah, I opened my door one day and a CD fell down onto the ground and I picked it up. It said your name, had three songs and then a show title or a show date. So I went to the show and you guys kicked butt. So, I mean, that's how we began. And then we were immediately selling shows out. We only had a three song demo and we were packing in 200 or 300 kids at these small clubs. That gave us enough money to go back into the studio and finish out our untitled full length, which later got us a record deal. So how it all started was those three things: staying connected with a real street team, real human beings who actually care about your band, that core first 50 fans who are not your cousin, uncle, brother, you know, not your relatives, not your best friends from high school, like these people who just really support your music for some reason. I can't explain it. Incentivize them with cool free stuff. We always gave them hats, stickers, tickets to the shows, you know, and took their opinion on things too. Like, hey, what do you think about this song? We play in demos and stuff. I mean, our street team had like heavy influence on like our original sound. We would play them like highly, highly questionable demos. And they would be like, oh, I don't know about this one. Or, oh yeah, this one sounds really good. And then we would actually take their advice. So the street team, passing out your own music, which these days, I guess, is just considered streaming. And the last one was never saying no to an opportunity. You know, like, we literally went, the radio station held a contest. The movie Dodgeball with, what's his name? Ben Stiller was out. So, the local radio stations are always doing these things. And they had a contest. If you come and with your dodgeball team and you win, you can win $1,000. Well, we wanted money for the studio. So we showed up as a band, as a five piece, and we entered the contest as the Red Jumpsuit Apparatus. They still talk about this to this day at the local radio station in our town. We got second place. We got beat by this group of guys in like matching Speedos. It was unreal. They were doing like backflips and throwing the ball. I mean, we got killed, but we worked our way all the way up to the end. And they're like, who are you guys? It's amazing that you did so well. What band are you in? And we told them the band name. It didn't really pan out to anything because we didn't win any money, but the radio station remembered our name. So later on, when they got the demo, they spun the song. So way before we had an A&R, way before we had a manager, there were local radio stations who were giving us a chance because we were so crazy and we were just showing up at all their events. Every time they had some kind of keg and eggs or this at the beach or that, we'd be there passing out CDs, doing something dorky, wearing a big cowboy, oversized cowboy hat with a sign that says, "Your mom loves our band." I mean, anything that we could think of that was completely stupid and wild, we did to get their attention. And then we gave them our music.
That what you're saying there is, how old were you at in 2001?
I was 19, 20 years old.
Yeah, so you're a teenager with a Bible and a beer, being as crazy as you could to get as much attention as you could. And it may be inadvertently, the thing, and that is a long time ago, but I was just listening to some podcast or something the other day, and what you're describing there would almost be some kind of predecessor masterclass on how a lot of the modern startups actually work. Like, you're way ahead, and it gives me opportunity to, like, show some of the really emergent cool stuff that people like in this scene are innovators that are ahead of their time. But like, all the network, a lot of what you're talking about there is what they call in modern startup language network effects, and starting with this and that. And they said that those social dating app networks, when they were catching on, when they were getting their the first thing they have to do is get this core user base, and they would go to college campuses and take the app and the phone and go get every person one at a time until you get 50, 100, 200. And then because these people are on it, these people get on, and the network effects, you know, do that. And that, you know how they go to college campuses and do gimmicks or throw a party. Like, that's what startups 10, 20 years later are doing to launch their startups, the founders with the hustle, you know, in these same kind of patterns that, you know, that you were doing as a 19-year-old kid kind of intuitively are essentially the methods that even modern startups use to generate these network effects that then spill over into get a momentum, own your hometown, and then you can replicate that in, you know, in other places and get the experience. Another big thing in startups is they do the user feedback. So they go, "Oh, we're a brand new startup. We talk to every customer. We take their feedback." We're doing that constantly. You're doing that with your street team. And, you know, so just all that stuff is, like, I mean, very, very cool. And you just stumbled into it from a first principles, like, how can we? And then you just problem solve your way through it because of the, I don't know, what was the drive that made you, because you did it for years, like, you did that for years?
Yes, that all started in 2000, in between two, well, like I said, this wasn't our first band. So first we tried it in our band called Dishonest, and then Red Jumpsuit was my side project. So I kind of had honed the craft by then. But, you know, at that point, we had been doing this kind of guerrilla marketing strategy for 3 to 4 years.
Mm-hmm. That's amazing. And so not the whole time you get the experience, oh yeah, singing, playing, performing, writing, watching other bands and go, oh, what works so it doesn't work on stage. So you get the reps in, but you really need that time. You can't just be a good singer. Like, in the older days, yeah, maybe especially to go to radio and have the kind of career that you had, it's not, maybe it's a singer and they get put together by the management and you don't have that real dirty experience of really doing it and owning it.
We had dirty, all right. One time we came up with the crazy idea, bring your mom, she'll get in free. And we put that on the flyers and we had no idea that people were going to take it seriously. And like 400 people showed up and 200 of them were moms. And the promoter's like, "What are you doing? All these people are saying their moms are getting in free. You're not going to make any money tonight. You're going to have to give me your money back." And we're like, "We don't give a shit." You know what I mean? Like, we didn't actually think it was going to work, but here we are playing a sold out show. We wound up doing $3,000 in merch. When you're 20 years old and you do $3,000 in merch, you're living on high on the hog. You know what I mean? Like, we could not believe it because those moms bought a shirt. You know what I mean? So it was really just a joke when we put it on the flyer. So things like that. Just whatever we could think of, man, like whatever would catch your eye. We wanted to be the weird, dorky band because the music speaks for itself.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but somewhere from that era, is there a story about some band saying something negative about God from stage and you have an altercation with the singer of that band?
Yeah.
Tell me that one.
Many times, actually, not just once, but I'm you know what? I have a personal relationship, and it's just like talking crap about my father. If you're going to stand there and say something bad about my dad, then I'm probably going to fight you. I'm probably going to fight you over it, or I'm going to want to fight you over it. And I'm not even a violent person, but I just draw the line with over-the-top rude disrespect. And there was also one time on Warped Tour where somebody threw a boot and hit me in the head. And I stopped the show and I pointed the guy out and I told the whole crowd, meet me over here after the set and let's see what happens. And I ran full speed off of the stage, around to the side, and he was gone. And I said, where's the guy with one? There's somebody out here with only one boot on, you know what I mean? Because he took the other one off to throw it at me. And it's probably because I used to say things like that. So again, we weren't the particular best examples of what you would call a Christian. But who is my question. I mean, I am the imperfect son. I am the one who went the wrong way. But that doesn't mean that I didn't have Jesus in my heart. It just means I'm an idiot. And I wanted to do things my way. That's all it means. And, you know, I learned through pain. And I'm still learning through pain. That's just the only way I know how to learn, because I'm not a perfect being. I'm just a regular ass dude.
And so it is literally true that you physically fought somebody for talking about God on stage.
Yes, it is true. And I would like to think that I won that brawl. But you know what? It depends on who's watching, I guess.
That's a really good illustration of some of that, the chaos, of all that. So you get, when you're having that kind of success and you're already on the radio and people see that you're doing that kind of money and merch, now the industry takes notice, obviously. So what was how did you go just leap right into major label? What was that relationship? I don't know how you got to it and how that went down.
Well, all the work that we did slowly paid off. Like I said, there was a radio personality called Lex and Terry who played one of our songs, but that was just like a 5 seconds of glory thing. Like, oh, we got spun on the radio. By no means was it they're adding the song to rotation or anything like that. But it gave us such a bolt of energy. Like, wow, they will actually do this. That it continued the fire that essentially I had. I mean, at this point, I had already lost. I think I was on my third guitar player, second drummer, and second bass player. So I was already on version 4.0 of Red Jumpsuit Apparatus before we even were heard by an A&R. Yeah, so I was just driven, and a lot of people had already left, so it was just all on me when it came to being driven. And if I finally got enough guys around me who were like, hey, this guy's crazy as hell, but we're just going to follow him. And that became kind of a somewhat stable lineup. Once that happened, a manager named Steve Tramposh, who still works with me today, 20 years later, he's my co-manager. So I do kind of like the touring and day-to-day stuff. I balance the budgets. I help route the tours with the agent. I make sure that the merch is paid on time. And he does almost more like A&R work, but we co-manage together. But he was my original manager all way back then. He was paying attention online, and there was the new thing, MySpace, right? MySpace just came out. And we just had a bunch of ton of whatever you call it. Like we made a page just like every other band. We didn't have any secret tactics with the social media. That's one part of our career that gets a little bit misconstrued, because I've heard people say, oh, well, you guys blew up on MySpace. Well, we blew up on MySpace after we were signed, not before we were signed.
And that's just when MySpace blew up itself. So it's just had its own thing.
Exactly. Yep. So every band on MySpace blew up together. So I don't really like it when people get that part of our story wrong. We were just another band on MySpace, like everybody else, who had a player and all that. We didn't really have any like huge numbers. But what happened was, because our music was online, a manager who was very savvy and just paying attention, he had connections around the country. He was connected with promoters. He called a local promoter from Jacksonville and said, hey, I just got hired onto a label for the second or third time, because that's how it goes with A&Rs. They make the rounds. You know, most A&Rs have worked for like 7 different labels. It's rare that you have a guy who just stuck with one. And then they call their contacts, if you will, which are typically actually concert promoters and booking agents. And they say, hey, you got any young talent out there that's kicking butt on their own without any help? And he goes, yeah, there's these crazy ass kids named Red Jumpsuit Apparatus who are just firing it up down here in Jacksonville. You know, they're keeping up with national acts, drawing in numbers, and they're playing all originals. So that's exactly what he told him, because he told me later, you know, exactly what he told him. So he goes, well, I'd like to meet these guys. So he reaches out via MySpace Messenger, and it was the sketchiest email ever. He's like, hey, I'm this guy from New York, and I really love your band. And if you work with me, I can get your record deal. We're like, oh, listen to this joker. I remember cracking a beer and being like, listen to this idiot. We're like making fun of him before we ever even talked to him. He wound up being a super cool guy and totally legit. His name was Steve Tramposh. So he goes, hey, I'll tell you what. How about I just meet you and I'll tell you about some of the things. I mean, we just didn't believe anything because, you know, this was before trolls were a thing, which means trolls were unlimited. Like before you knew what a troll was, everybody was a troll. I mean, times were different back then. Like you could mess with anybody however you wanted to, and everybody was doing it 24/7. Catfishing, you know, catfishing was just now coming out. I mean, it was the Wild West back then. So we were like, this is probably some kid from Jacksonville. We were convinced it was somebody that we knew that was playing a prank on us.
That's a fascinating point, if you don't mind the interruption, that it was, you know, it wasn't as developed in the modern sense where everybody was trying to do this legit e-commerce thing. But there was no reputational damage for any online behavior. Nah. Like whatever you could do, you couldn't get in trouble. You couldn't get retweeted or highlighted or screenshot. Like that wasn't a thing. So whatever behavior you could do. And it wouldn't blow back on you.
Right. And we were aware of that. So we didn't take anything serious. Plus when you had the attitude that we did, like I said, with the, you know, bring your mom, she'll get in free. We were almost as rambunctious as like a Blink-182. Like we were known for being that way. You can't cancel a band who doesn't give a shit. It's literally not possible because they don't care enough to be canceled and their fans don't care enough to cancel them. You know, so even then, we kind of always just had that mentality, like from the very beginning. If you make fun of yourself first, how much can they really make fun of you? I mean, look at the band name. It kind of proves that we didn't really take anything seriously. So we just thought it was a joke. Anyway, this guy shows up and he's all clean cut. He's got this, you know, back then, not everything was digital. This huge booklet of bands that he'd worked with. He'd worked with Metallica. He'd worked with just Dream Theater because he was at Elektra for a while. There's pictures of him with everybody. Shows his name, says A&R. We're like, hold on. We go to the room. Dude, this guy's legit, man. Like, he's really actually somebody. Like, this is crazy. Like, wow, we probably should have, like, wore nicer clothes. I mean, like, we were all dirt dogged out, you know, in Southern Florida, just, like, basically redneck, you know, just jam boys. We weren't ready for that. So we kind of gained our composures and came back in the room and we're like, all right, what do you want? What do you want from us? Because we're like, what is this all about? He's like, I want to sign you to a management deal. Then I want to take your demos and I want to shop them to the labels. Then I want to get you a record deal. And then I want you to become a real band instead of a garage band. And I think you can do it. And we were just like, you know what I mean? But essentially it was really him just talking to me because the guitar player in the room had probably only been there for 3 days because I just fired the other guy last week. You know? So, I mean, really, he was kind of just talking to me, but it was that moment. It was that moment where I'm like, holy shit. Like we got some attention here from somebody who really matters. And then he turned around and did exactly what he said he was going to do. He took my music. He shopped it. He found me an attorney. He got label interest. Unfortunately, the first label I wanted to sign was Tooth and Nail, and they said, hell no, we'll never sign these guys. We've already heard about them. They're crazier than a fruit bat. So we got a hard no from them. So then I went to Fueled by Ramen. They told me no because they said I sounded too mainstream. So then I went to Fat Records. They told me no because they said that I sounded too mainstream. So I was like, okay, so we're too crazy for some labels. We're too mainstream for some other labels, where do we go? And he goes like, well, there's only one place left, the majors. And I was like, are they signing stuff like this? And he was like, well, can't hurt to try. Boom, we got signed to Virgin Records. I mean, like less than 2 months later, they heard it. He had a friend named Jason Flom who just recently, they were buddies before Jason got hired as president. And Jason calls him and goes, I need somebody great, young, and not afraid, and super edgy. He goes, I just signed a band called Red Jumpsuit Apparatus that you might not even be able to handle, but they're great and they have a good message, but they're wild as hell. They're Florida boys. We're not going to be able to tame them. You know, that was basically how the conversation went, but they're really great. Let me play the music. He loved it right away. He called me the next day. I didn't know who Jason Flom was. He's like, hey man, I heard you guys were a little crazy, but I really love your music. You think you can rein it in and put your big boy pants on and come work for Virgin Records? And I was like, yes, sir, I do. And there you go. You know, we signed the record contract, and as they say, the rest was history.
Well, Jason Flom is a big name. I think he pioneered some of these crossover acts. Like, I don't know. I know his name, and I can't place all of his history, but I know he's one of those guys that saw the value in this, in that area, it seems like.
Absolutely. Yeah, well, his biggest, he was just coming off a huge win with a band called Simple Plan, which a lot of people wrote off. They thought it was too poppy. And they came out and just dominated. They were probably one of the first, what I would say, pop punk emo bands to really just take over the airwaves. So they kind of paved the way for us. So he really just recreated what he did with Simple Plan with our band.
Mm-hmm. And so then then it just goes straight into rate. Like, you skip over a lot of steps, and it's on the radio, and then you almost were almost at Take Action at that point. So what was it just went to how did that go? How did that part, that explosion to radio go?
It wasn't quite as fast as you're describing, because that process itself takes over a year. So from the signing day, which was October, I'll never forget it, October 27, 2005, our album didn't come out until July 16th. Which is the following year. So nobody's actually that was when it came out. So until then, nobody heard of our band. So for 1 year straight after making the album, we were playing pizza parlors. We were playing VFW halls. We were playing, the dirtiest dirt of that can be, the very, very bottom of the post-hardcore emo circuit, because that was the only option. No, we didn't even have an album out. We did have demos, and every time we would play a show, we would pass them out. But because we were signed to a record deal, we weren't allowed to distribute our music. They owned distribution, and they insisted on what they call a rollout. And the rollout didn't start until July 16th. So essentially, it was a long, hard year of...
You doubted during that year?
I didn't at first, but after 45 to 60 just terrible shows in a row, where literally there's 15 kids in the crowd, and those 15 kids are actually not really there to see you. They're there to see their friend's band. You know what I mean? Like, there were some times, but then we would go back to Florida and we would do 600, 800, just huge numbers, and everybody would sing every song. I think sometimes when we were out there away from home, the doubts came in, and then everything changed when the album finally dropped. I remember where we were. We were on Warped Tour, and we were in Canada the day. So we didn't even get to celebrate it because it came out in the U.S., but we were in Vancouver. And there's about 30 kids in front of our stage. And I was like, hey, we're the Red Gem Super Apparatus. And 30 kids were like, ooh. I mean, you know how it goes when it's just one row across the front? Mm-hmm. It's like
the single row. One. Yeah.
Yeah. And they're all stretched out. You wish they would almost just bunch together a little bit, And it was not much pomp and circumstance. And then there was two Canada shows, and then we cross back into the U.S. and we do our Warped Tour set, and it's 3,000 kids in front of our stage in Seattle on the Kevin Says side stage, and we're like, "Whoa, what's going on?" So that's when all of a sudden, that's when it went pow out of nowhere. And Take Action Tour was about 6 months after that.
Warped Tour 06.
Yeah, so Take Action Tour is about 4 to 6 months after that. So right. Warped Tour is just. Our album dropped on Warped Tour, so that's when the big shift happened. Because the first half of the tour, our album wasn't out. Nobody knew who we were. We were just another band lost in a sea of bands. Then mid tour, we were like, "Pow!" We just shot up out of nowhere because the album was finally out. People finally got to listen to it and hear it and see what it was like. And they did this very well. They crafted the single hitting at radio right at the same time that the album dropped. So, that's hats off to Virgin and Jason Flom on that one. That had nothing to do with me.
Plus Warped Tour.
Plus Warped Tour.
But straight into a headliner with a brand. I mean, that's just perfect. Like, all that is it's just this perfect leapfrog. Well-designed, right? Everything that led up to that, it just couldn't have been any better.
Right. And I can take zero credit for that other than writing the song, and being the singer. That's when the power of being with a major label came. We got to see... Here's this, then this, then this, then this, and it just ramped up like they said it would.
That's a dream. I mean, it's just a weird dream to think about that. And so then you have what enters in then is every this is just another dynamic that you just encounter over and over again. There's no map from there for a young man, a crazy young man. One of the main qualities that all these bands and people have is they are, you know, you could use the word rambunctious, but they're punk, they're defiant, they didn't act right in school, they challenge the bound, they do crazy stuff anyway, and then they're really successful and have a lot of power. Now the whole world is open to you, and you still have these qualities of, okay, but I'm supposed to rebel against everything. That's who I am. That's how I got here, and now all the dynamics around you are changed. There's no map. There's no real guidance. Like, now you're just out in the world with six of your buddies, and now that's a really crazy recipe.
Yeah, and madness ensued. You know?
Tell me about that.
You know, we were one of the craziest bands there were. you can ask anybody, and, you know, Warped Tour 07 is really when, you know, because 06 is when the album came out. So by 07, we were now main staging. So it was us, Paramore, Under Oath, Bad Religion, every night, rotating on the two main stages. You know, we're in a bus. We're sponsored by Jägermeister and Miller Lite. I mean, they're literally bringing us pallets and just dropping it off to our bus. We got a thing called a Jägerator machine, so the alcohol was flowing. I never got into drugs, thank God. I'd probably be dead. But we you know, we just became known as, you know, the new Motley Crue. You know, we had long hair, we wore tight jeans, and we partied as hard as you could. And we really, I can't believe I'm still alive, to be honest with you. I can't believe I survived Warped 07. And then that went into another headliner, and that went into another headliner, and that went into another headliner. And that's when they kind of just kept us on the road for almost 2 years straight. And I don't remember almost any of that. It's sad. It's sad to say. But I know it was a lot of shows, and I know it was a lot of just, you know, all the stories that you ever hear about. I've seen it all and done it all.
Do you recall it? Did you experience it on the level of your personal ego and self changing the nature of how you saw yourself and how you related to, you know, other people in society? If you can introspect that a little bit.
It's when you're asking me that question, it's complicated because I personally wouldn't view myself that way because I've never really ran into anybody who said I was egotistical. I've been called a drunk asshole plenty of times because what happened is I became a ferocious alcoholic. That's what happens. And most ferocious alcoholics, they're not super cocky. They're just really inward. So what happened is I drove even more inward, and my depression, which should have been smaller, the same thing that I was talking about and helping people go through there and take action tour, after that tour got worse. I was now suffering from something more than I was previously, but specifically with me, it was due to the massive amounts of alcohol that I was drinking, which is a depressant. But try telling that to a 24-year-old kid. They're not going to listen to you. Like, whatever, bro. Shut up. I'm having a good time. So it was masked under a happy face, but I was really going through a lot of inward turmoil when it comes to dealing with the fame, if you will. I never really been accused of looking down on anybody. I've never really been accused a lot, but not that. We never really have been the band that thought we were better than anyone. I've never encountered a band that said that about us. We were just crazy, man. And always getting into straight up bar brawls, you know, like we would bust out into a fight with the security staff more than once. One time at a radio station, I got headbutted in front of the entire crowd by a security guard. And then I'm just sitting here wailing him on the head. And we're about to go on. The intro for the song is happening. And I'm straight duking it out with the security guard on the rail in front of like 10,000 people. You know, it was just madness. You know, like, and why did that happen? Because he had a swastika on the back of his neck and he was harassing a black fan of ours. And I ran over, and another kid who was in a band who was trying to get over the rail. So I came over there and I called him out. And he turned around and he grabbed me by the back of the neck and he headbutted me and the blood just started coming out. And then it just turned into a brawl. You know, and like all my fans jumped on. It was insane. And then I walked on stage with blood pouring out of my face and we played the set. And he got beat down and carted out of the arena. So, I mean, again, we've never really been, in my opinion, you'd have to ask somebody else. We've never been the band who thought they were better than everybody else, but we were completely off the rails when it comes to, like, we were out of control.
Yeah. Yeah. It was like you had a confidence that you're, it's, you have a confidence that you're able to project that's part of performing, and it comes from somewhere that you have. So, I mean, ego is not exactly the right thing I'm saying, but you as a performer empowered with the fans and the what you're able to generate in the, in those environments was, you know, is still, like, the last time I saw you was in Denver at Is for Lovers, and you're able to generate something that I think is really unique, as a performer.
I appreciate it. I don't know, like, you know, you're a performer. I feel like, I don't know how you would describe it, but I really just feel like I'm doing my job, you know, like I've, like you said earlier, I got to watch so many awesome bands come up before me, and they were killer. You know, they were, I got to see AFI in a 500 seat venue and nobody knew who they were. You know, I got to see NOFX in an 800 seat venue before they were massive. I got to see Blink when nobody knew who they were. And they had that, I guess, star power or whatever you want to call it. And I just learned it from them. I didn't, it's not something that came from me. I just watched how they did it. And I adapted it to my own version, and then I regurgitated.
And I just said Denver, but I meant Wichita was the place, the last one I saw you at. I'm looking forward to doing more Is for Lovers with you this year, but that was Wichita particularly on that one. But some people compare you to Axl Rose. You get that from time to time?
No, I've never heard that.
Oh, come on. You've never heard people compare you to Axl Rose. That's it's like it's something about the, you know, you said Motley Crue earlier. There's something from that era that you feel, it feels that you are able to bring.
I mean, I take it as a compliment. That's for sure. I mean, Axl's a freaking beast. You know what I mean? He's a beast. I've heard it from, like, the only time I'd ever heard that was from people who were like 65, you know, and didn't really understand the genre. And they're like, oh, he's like a young Axl Rose. And I just assumed it's because I had long, straight hair.
That's part of it. It conjures that. But just the elevated performance. Axl's a great singer, obviously. And the performance and the long hair and everything. But, you know, it kind of, some of the stuff you do spans across era. And then also you're embedded in the particular context of the punk and emo and hardcore kind of thing. So it's like you're like this. You're able to draw from lots of things and then bring it into a focal point. I mean, that's just kind of as a performer, something like that is what I'm trying to say.
So I'm the emo Axl Rose is what you're saying.
Maybe.
Yeah. All right. I'll take it, man. Yeah, I'll take it.
If that's a compliment, you should run with that. Yes. Yes.
It is definitely a compliment.
Good. Good. I mean it as such. Your vocal style, even, I'm trying to think of a good way to discuss your vocal style, but I mean, obviously singer songwriter, we're just talking about your personality mostly so far, but your singer, I'm curious what you would add to the conversation. If I don't have a better way of putting my foot in my mouth from it, what do you think is unique about the way that you are a vocalist and songwriter? Because obviously we have the part where you're bringing in the lyrics, the cultural issues, Face Down particularly. The lyrics of that song play a big part in your, you know, career and how well you're known. But I would like for you to help me take it from the lyrics of that song to your, you know, vocal style and songwriting, if you could take me down that path.
Sure. You know, to this day, because we've looked into this kind of stuff, because we've always been curious. I'm not sure if you guys have. We've done some SEO searching on, what is the highest searched topic about our band? We wanted to know, what is it? Is it this guy? Is it this song? Is it this music video? The number one thing searched about my band from the history of our inception until today has been the lyrics from the beginning, year after year. And we've ran the search every year because we've always been curious to see if it changed. At a certain point when you've been a band this long, you're like, has it changed yet? Has it changed yet? No. Every single year, because you can run, you can hire companies to just collect data for you real quick. It's actually relatively cheap. And we've been doing it forever. And it's just number one, every single time, it's not anything other than the same thing by far, it's lyrics. So I don't know. I just really, when I write my lyrics, I just take my time, man. I will not let anybody rush me. And I'm very just stubbornly, I'm just such an asshole about anybody that has an opinion on my lyrics. I just won't listen to you. I just don't care what any producers think. I don't care what any of my band members think. I don't care what anybody thinks about my lyrics, and I never have. I'm very specific about what I want to say. I've spent a crap ton of time crafting it, and I'm not. And I know when it's done. Until it's and when I'm done, it's like I don't want to hear anything about it. If anybody has, I've been to so many bands meetings where I'm hanging out with my buddies, and they're all talking about a song, and they're like, "Ah, this line's cool, but maybe we should change this line." Man, that didn't fly with me. And everybody knew that. Don't even think about bringing up lyrics around me, or there's going to be a problem. You know, there's going to be a serious problem. So we could talk about guitar. We could talk about drums. I can change any of that. I'm fine with that. You want to change the bass line? Go for it, man. I won't touch it. You want to change the drums around? Be my guest. You want to add something to the guitar riff? I suck at guitar anyway. More the merrier. Have a good time. You came up with a keyboard line? Sick, dude. Throw it on there. But you got one thing to say about the lyrics, and I'm going to kick you out of the room. And I would kick people out of the room. You know, I'm not interested. So I think just my stubbornness and attentiveness to the lyrics has done me well.
Yeah, and particularly on, you know, Face Down, there's the theme of, I guess, domestic abuse is the theme on that one. And do you, you know, I'm sure you've been asked about a million times, so I don't feel that I can ask the question in the original way. But on the conception and the, I'll just ask it from the writer's standpoint, what do you recall the, when those lyrics came out into?
Absolutely. I recall it like it was yesterday. You know, Don't You Fake It is exactly what it was. That album was a reflection of me just talking about what I was going through. So every single song, including Face Down on that album, is just something that I went through relatively recently. It was a collection of lyrics that I put to a post-hardcore emo background. So Face Down is a song that's about my mom. My dad, unfortunately, beat the crap out of my mom multiple times and beat me and my brothers badly. He was a very, very sick alcoholic when I was a child. And my mom was also on some drugs as well. So it was a very toxic household, the very opposite of everything that you could imagine. I'm hanging out here in my kid's room right now, which basically looks like a preschool. So thank God I was able to break the cycle. It was just very extremely graphic in my home. There was a lot of blood and broken toys and broken glass and bruising and physical violence. So when that, as I was writing Don't You Fake It, it was natural for me to write about that. It was just something that me and my brother had gone through. So the first song on the album was called In Fate's Hands, because that's what I felt like I was in. And the first line is, I remember a year ago, I was standing in the crowd waiting for my chance to break through. I'm talking to the people about me. I'm just literally coming up with it off the top of my head and writing it down. So by the time I got to Face Down, for some reason that day, I was just thinking about my mom. And I was, you know, as usually depressed and kind of pissed off about it. And I came up, I was mad at my dad because I had just recently turned like maybe 18, 19, and I was big enough to do something about it now. And I knew I was going to see him that weekend, and I planned on kicking his ass. That was what I was going to do. And I was going to confront him. So I had an acoustic guitar, and I came up with this line. Do you feel like a man when you push her around? Do you feel better now she falls to the ground? I'm talking to my dad, you know, and I'm writing it. And then I called my friend and go, hey, man, I think I came up with a really good song. And the kind of the anger kind of dropped because now I'm in music mode, you know, and I'm just like, oh, okay. And then I played it for my friend and he goes, I don't know, man. It sounds kind of Nickelback-y to me. And I was like, oh, dude, like what? Like, you know, back then that was a diss, you know, like if someone said you sound like Nickelback, that wasn't a good thing. So he was like, yeah, don't they have a song about that? I was like, oh, no, man, this is about me, like about what I'm going through. And he was like, oh, I didn't know you were going through that, bro. And it got like serious for a second. And, you know, and that was kind of at the peak of it. I'd actually been removed from that situation and my grandparents adopted us, but I would still get flashbacks, you know, of when it happened. And it didn't really affect me as much until I turned about 18, is when I really started getting a lot of memories of how bad it was and a lot of anger and a lot of resentment, towards my father. And, you know, we worked it out later, my whole family and we're all good now. You know, everything is okay now, but at the time we weren't. So I put it into a song like I did everything else.
That's a really amazing way to think about it. That I like the way you notice that you, the when you go into music mode and develop, like you use music as this way to deal with stuff that's inside of you, and then you bring it out, and then that lowers something, stress, anger, or whatever it is, and then becomes useful, and then that goes into a song. That's, I mean, Spotify hadn't been didn't start tracking until 10 years after that came out, and it's approaching 400 million plays on Spotify, and that missed the first 10 years of that song's, how many times it was on the radio, how many times it was shared, downloaded, listened to on repeat. So like the impact of that song is just staggering because of such a resonant, like how many people have gone through that? Obviously a lot, and you're able to pull it into, take it from this, whatever that emotion and terror and thing is, and then bring it into a context where then it can really do things, like, you know. And that makes me think about, like, you said something earlier still about how, and this is just me, it just moves me emotionally, that the music thing is an important thing that does something. It's, and you said it's like a different kind of church. What did you say about it's the real church? I don't know. You said something earlier that makes me, that flashes me to that. Do you remember what you said?
Not particularly, but just, you know, this to me, that it's music is spiritual. You know, it is it in itself. I don't know. It's the only thing that's ever worked for me, is all I can say, compared to all of the other methods out there.
It worked for you. And then it worked for other people. It connected to other people. It connected people together, and it worked. It did. It accomplished something, is what I'm hearing you say. It accomplished something for you personally, and then that then connected people and accomplished things for them, is the only way I could explain it. It must.
Yeah, and the wildest thing, man, is what, you know, is we would play a show, and then I would have this single mom come up to me and say, "I just got out last week," with tears coming down her face, and grabbing me by the arms and saying, "Thank you for making that song." And then the next, we would play a show the next night, and that says, "I left my husband 2 years ago. Thanks to you, I was driving down the road and that song came on, and I looked in the rearview mirror and I saw my kid's face, and I said, 'I've had enough.' And I slammed my hand on the steering wheel and I never went back." I mean, the stories that people have shared with me over this song would literally blow your mind.
I wouldn't doubt it. I mean, the numbers and the stories you don't know, there's way more of those. There's way more than you've ever heard of those stories that you've not had the opportunity to hear.
You know, I never actually thought about that. I feel I've been confronted by so many people. I mean, they find it important to single me out after the show and to find me, you know, in the alleyways, and or if I'm at a bank or I'm at a mall and somebody recognizes me, it's always the same thing. It's never, it's always their escape story, how my song helped them escape. And I think they could hear the rage in my voice. I think they could understand that I wasn't faking this shit. When you hear this song, you know that this is something that I went through.
Mm-hmm. That's really, really powerful. And I love, you know, the background of where you are, the way that you said you have broken the cycle, but you know, as far as we've covered so far in this interview, we've just gotten up to the point where you also become alcoholic. So you
we're
didn't
stuck kind of in the middle there.
Yeah. We got to pick back up there where, you know, the cycle doesn't seem to have been broken thus far in, you know, 2009 or wherever we are.
Correct. However, I was not a dad yet. So okay. as many dads know, that will change you. And I'd heard people say stuff like that. But until you are one, you don't get it. You just don't get it. I can't explain it to somebody who's not a father. But so after what I call the virgin years, we made one more album for Virgin, which was called Lonely Road. It debuted 16 on the charts. And we came out with a really kind of aggressive Southern rock song called You Better Pray, which actually did extremely well once again on radio. But a lot of the punk scene kids didn't like it because it wasn't upbeat and it didn't have the screamo vibe. But the album did fine. And it later, you know, it's got millions nothing like Face Down per se, but it's got plenty of streams. A lot of people heard the record and it did well. And we still play those singles today. That was our second album. After that, we left Virgin. And that's when I would say kind of the Virgin years ended. And we went back to kind of where we came from, which was back into the underground. And I became obsessed with trying to be the biggest underground band that there was. And so we released music independently since now, all the way up until 2023. But after being at such high highs, when you leave a label, it's always a little shaky. You know, we were kind of really taken care of with Virgin. They really did everything for us. And I didn't really have any idea what I was doing. So we kind of went right on our faces, you know. The next couple of releases,
and you're an intro. You've got withdrawn into yourself. You're an alcoholic, and then there's you know, that all happens. That's
right.
I mean,
all that's at this time. Yeah. So we kind of quickly rapid fire put like an EP out, an album out, and then another EP out, and that's all in about a 4-year time span. So now we're talking from 2009-10 to about 2014, right around then, and then I got divorced, you know, because my alcoholism was at its peak. And I had gone through another 3 or 4 different versions of the band. Multiple members had come and gone, but that wasn't anything new. And I was just, you know, a really angry drunk. That's just all I was. I was just kind of a bitter, used to be famous, angry drunk guy that would occasionally put out a new album and tour. I mean, we still sold shows out the entire time. I'm not going to lie. There was never a time where we weren't killing it on the underground, but I was. If you ever see photos of me from that era, I was about 235 pounds, and today I'm about 140. So I got really big and just really mass-wise, you know, overweight, and I was just very grumpy and grouchy, and I just wanted to stay drunk all the time. I was just a very miserable person to be around. And then I met a girl in California, and I fell in love with her, and she told me, if you want to be with me, you got to get sober. I really like you. I think you're a good person. I can tell that you have a kind heart, but you're addicted to alcohol, and you're never going to have a chance with somebody like me unless you get sober. So she introduced me to something called Alcoholics Anonymous, which I've never heard of. I've never heard of it. Literally, I've never heard of it. I guess it's super known. See, I can tell by your reaction, but. Where I'm from, let me tell you something. Where I'm from, people don't sit around and talk about AA, all right? it's not a thing. People run from it like the plague where I'm from. I'm from a community of drinkers, not just a family, a community. Everybody where I came from is just the way of life. And it's okay. I don't look down on them, and they didn't look down on me, and I still don't look down on them. It's how we cope. It's how we cope some places in the South. With, you know, the places that I lived in the areas that I was in. It's a way to get by. You know, it is what it is. But the medicine stops working eventually. And that's, if anybody's watching, I want them to know that. You know, the medicine only works for so long. And then now it's controlling you. So I went to my first AA meeting, and I liked it a lot. I think I had about 30 days where I was still trying to figure out what the whole, I didn't understand that it meant that you can't drink forever for the rest of your life. I thought it was like a way to like curb your drinking or whatever. So I can't really say I was sober the first 30 to 60 days. But then I finally understood what it was. And that was 7.5 years ago. That was 2014, 15. So I spent between 2014 and 15 trying to figure out how to get sober through Alcoholics Anonymous. And then once it finally caught, I've been sober ever since. A year after that, almost to the day, my son was born. So when he was born, I had 1 year and 13 days sober from alcohol. And he is now 6, and I got 7.5 years sober.
That's amazing. It's amazing the way that works out. You know, like I wouldn't have predicted such from knowing you before. I mean, I think I'm, another memory I have is just like, I don't know exactly how to place this, but I remember doing Soundwave Festival, and you didn't seem at your best at that time. You know, I don't know if you remember that. You had a bodyguard, and you know, and I didn't see you for several years after that. And you know, it's clear that there's been such a big change, you know, in recent years, and that it's very real, and it's just not one that I would have predicted, you know. And so it's been really amazing to see. And that, you know, anytime there's a cycle broken for real, like that's amazing stuff. And I think that's really cool. The AA, something that I think is fascinating about AA that I really like, not that I'm in AA, but from what I understand about it is it really forces people to be really brutally honest and authentic, which has always been some of the values that people like us tend to have, is that really aggressively brutal honesty, or whatever, that radical transparency about things, or like looking at things for what they are, trying to get at that, at least the realness there. So it's, that's really amazing to see.
Yes, I remember Soundwave, and that was at the peak. You know, that was right. That's right around the time I was talking about. I want to say 2012-ish something. So that's right before I tried starting to get sober. And the reason why I had to have a bodyguard with me is because I was constantly getting in bar fights all the time. And the reason why I was getting in bar fights is because I would wake up drunk and stay drunk throughout the day. And it's only a matter of time before you piss somebody off. Like I said, I wasn't necessarily known as an egotistical person, but I was definitely known as a drunk asshole. And they're not the same thing. You know, until I was too drunk, I was actually really fun to hang out with. I'd be the first one to buy you three shots, your friend three shots, and his friend three shots. I'd be the first one to take you to the roulette table and gamble with you all night long. But then somewhere during the evening, I would turn. And what we call that is a blackout. And the problem is I wouldn't remember it. I would never remember what happened. And I'd wake up the next day either with bruises and bruised knuckles or bruised eyes. Either I won or they won. It doesn't really matter. Either way, there was some kind of altercation. So I had to have a bodyguard with me. So when I blacked out, he could take me and put me away, drag me off. You know, it was really a babysitter. You know, we can call it a bodyguard. That makes me feel a little bit better about it. But the truth is, it was a babysitter. That's really what he was. And it was just to keep me out of trouble, man, because I couldn't do it myself. And these days, I'm just so far from that. I'm the first person to put my hand out and say, "How you doing?" It's addiction, man. It's a beast. It's a really tough battle, and you can't always see it when you're in it. Luckily enough for me, I cared enough about somebody who cared enough about me to tell me what was going on in my face, you know. And I had this opportunity to be with this person that I absolutely adored and that I was very much almost obsessed with. And there was an ultimatum, a very clear ultimatum put in front of me, the bottle or the girl. And I made the right choice. And because of that, I'm a family man. Because of that, I'm still happily married today. Because of that, I have the family that and the house that I've always dreamed of. And because of that, I've actually found true happiness.
That's amazing. It took me a while to understand the transformation that you had. You know, one of those people that you could, first of all, that situation of having those blackouts. There's tons of stories that people may have or know about you that you don't know about you. That's another one of those weird things. Which is, you know, it's just that's part of the whole thing. And somebody that I know that's known you for a long time, you know, in the before and after, is just JT Woodser from Hawthorne Heights. You know, he's been such a good, he's one of those guys, he's a true North guy that you can count on across time and know he sees people, he engages with people, he does very cool things. And he's always been somebody who's known you, done stuff with you. He's a supporter of yours. And, you know, that seems like a very cool relationship. I wonder who he is to you.
Oh, I love JT, man. He's such an awesome guy. And I don't know why he's still my friend. I can tell you that, because that just speaks for the caliber of his personality. And not just JT, you know, everybody else in the band too, because they were around for a lot of this stuff, you know. And I guess it's just because I was such a fan of their band. Even when we toured together, I would be out there in the mosh pit with you know, a beer can, spill it all over me, singing "Ohio Is for Lovers," and not just that, whatever the newest single was. And then we would go up and do our set after that, or vice versa, you know what I mean? So I like to think that maybe that helped smooth over some of the embarrassing moments I had. But I had literally one experience with them where I was on the back of the bus and they had to sit me down and tell me what happened the night before, because they realized that I had no idea. And that was one of those moments where it kind of raises above embarrassment to what we call shame. I was ashamed. I was like, wow. But it's hard to be ashamed of something that you have no memory of. So you're literally having to just take their word for it. And it was a really stupid thing. It was my guitar player got some new shoes, and he's still in the band today. And he's a fantastic player, Josh, our lead player. And he was all excited about him. And I don't know what happened. Like I said, that's what happens to people who black out. There's somebody else in control. So you never know what they're going to do. For some reason, I took my bowl of soup and I dumped it into his shoes. Now, I want to think in my mind it was some kind of playful, tour prank thing I thought I was doing. But really, it just ruined his day. He really liked the shoes. He just got them. He didn't have a lot of money. He didn't even, he didn't have an extra $50 in his pocket to buy another pair of shoes, and they were brand new. And I stormed the bus the next day, asking every single person who did it with an intense face, "Did you do it? Did you do it? Did you mess with my guitar player shoes?" And then finally, nobody said anything. Everybody's like, "No, man, it wasn't me. It wasn't me." And then I asked the bus driver. I mean, I was mad. I was going to fight somebody over it. I mean, I was literally livid because I knew how much he cared about those shoes. JT pulled me aside. He's like, "Ron, I got to talk to you." I was like, "What's up, bro?" Because he's always been cool with me. I've never had an altercation with anybody in that band or JT. And he's like, "Man, we can't see you. We can't see you like this anymore. Like, we got to tell you, it was you." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And he was like, "It was you. We saw you. You dumped the soup on the shoes." And I was just like, "Oh my God, am I that crazy? I've completely lost my mind." So they were literally there with me the moment, one of the most embarrassing, shameful moments of my entire life, of my recollection of being alive, was being hand delivered to me by JT. And then here we are a couple of years later on the acoustic tour, and I'm probably like a year and a half, 2 years sober, and they're just like, "Dude, you're back." I'm like, "What do you mean? Like, you're back to normal you. Like, this is fantastic. Like, you look good, you sound good, like, you look healthy, you're not dumping soup on anybody's shoes." And then the whole room just started laughing. And I said, "Yeah, well, I found my way to AA." And since then, between then and here and everywhere in between, we've just been really great friends. And I'm just appreciative for people like him in my life that didn't give up on me, that didn't just write me off as another addict loser, that waited and had the patience and the compassion to let me find my own path, and to not, they easily could have never toured with us again, or just, they easily could have just blackballed me from their group and from their tribe, because all bands, there's tribes of bands, there's different groups that hang out together, and they never did anything but show me love and kindness the whole time, even when I was a total jerk.
JT is, and all those guys, there's something special. JT's a straight edge guy. He didn't drink, but he accepted you in that time. He really goes by his values. Like, he has real values. He builds things. He puts things back. He creates things. He's been that way just absolutely since the first time I met him, before they were big in 2004 to now. They're not like other people. That's a very special group of people. I'm so glad to hear that. It rhymes with what your wife did, which is, he's a truth teller. It's like, this is firm. It's in love. It's compassionate. But this is how it is, and I'm going to tell you that. A lot of people don't get that. A lot of people, having those opportunities of people who are willing to face you and tell you the truth, even though you might be known to not take truth well sometimes. You know what I mean? It's like somebody's going to step in there, and whatever's going to happen next, they're going to tell you the truth. JT is one of those people, and that's a beautiful thing.
It was, man. And even the way they did it in kindness. Nice. I think they knew how disappointed I was going to be in myself when they told me, They let me down soft. That's all I can say, because it must have been strange to see me berating each person of the crew and band about what they actually all personally knew that I did. That must have been, I've never actually asked them what that felt like, but that must have been strange.
Mm-hmm. So you guys got a lot going. You've got new music coming out this year, and we've got a bunch of Is for Lovers festivals. Which ones are you guys on? Do you know off the top of your head?
We're on quite a few of them. I was told, I'm just gonna
I can
say
look it up.
I could probably miss one, but I was told that we're on all of them except for Hawaii. And Hawaii is actually this weekend. Are you guys playing the Hawaii day?
Yeah, depending on when this airs, we probably just got back from Hawaii and sorry you weren't there.
Okay, there you go. We're booked in Alaska and we couldn't get off of it. But I was there. I was literally in the room. I was in the room for one of the groundbreaking moments when JT came up with this thing. And I remember saying to him, you guys have a song called Ohio is for Lovers. Why don't you do a festival in Ohio called Ohio is for Lovers? And he was like, I'm thinking about doing that, but I'm thinking about doing something a little bit bigger. And I remember when he told me that, and this is just way before it was on paper, and this is way before a whole bunch of bands signed on, and it was way before it was reality. And I just watched him create this thing and build this thing, and I'm just so – I'm never impressed, man. I'm never impressed, but I'm impressed by that guy. He really – it's not – it's exactly like I was telling you earlier, like with the way that we built our band with the street team. He's just not going to take a shit from nobody. You know, he's got it in his mind. He sees – him and I have talked about this a lot of times – other people in the industry monetizing off the scene that we built, you know, and there's all these out, these interlopers, there's all these people who want to try to make money off of the scene who have nothing to do with this scene and the honesty and the integrity.
It's values. Yeah, exactly.
They got nothing to do with it. And he roped it all back, man. He got it all back together. He brought all the homies back together. He did it in a fashion that I, my hat's off to him. I commend him. I don't know how he had the, he's so business savvy, and he always has been. And he's also just cunning. He's very cunning and an intelligent man. And I couldn't be more happy for him. I say all the success to him in the world. And then I remember the last thing I said to him is, I think you're the new Kevin Lyman. And he just looked at me funny.
That's awesome. From the festivals you did last year, can you describe what that festival feels like? Because my experience was just being at it. It's like this, because there's a lot of times you go to a festival and it's like, this environment sucks. It's hard to be for me to explain what's tangible about that. But when I show up at the Is for Lovers Festival, I go, okay, this is right. Do you have any words for what's different about that environment? Because it's just a festival ground with a bunch of bands. Why is it so different?
I do. I mean, honestly, I hope the fans realize the camaraderie that is at these shows is at an all-time high. These are not just bands who are in a similar genre. These are bands who kind of came up together. These are bands who have been through the trenches. These are bands who have had huge hits and no hits and everywhere in between. And we've crossed paths multiple times. And it's like a dream lineup of bands for bands, which makes it amazing for fans because what I noticed was every band was having a blast. Like, I've been to many festivals where, because of the environment, like you said, everybody's just a little bit this or that. And you can kind of see it in the performance or there for the paycheck, if you will. And that's just not what's going on at Is for Lovers. We're all just having a good ass time, you know? And I really think it shows. And every single band that I've seen perform, it's been like the best sets I've seen from these bands. You know what I mean? And I think that even just going to the behind the stage care that they take care of the artist. There's just so much more consideration into how they lay the catering out. I mean, you name it, you know, the layout of the set times all seems to make sense. Nothing just seems to be blatantly dumb. And you can just tell that they've really thought this thing through. They're not, you know, killing you on the merch cuts, you know, just everything is just fantastic about it. From a business sense to a camaraderie sense to, I mean, just look at the lineup. It's even crazier this year. I didn't think that they were going to be able to top last year, but they did this year. So no it's doubt. Just, I'm just honored to be a part of it.
Yeah, it's really cool. And it's like, how simple does it have to be that somebody, it just takes somebody that has the values and believes and knows it to build what we need for ourselves. It doesn't have to come from the outside. It's like, who better to know how a festival should run than a guy in a band? But we're usually too busy doing other stuff or feel like we need somebody else to do it for us. But the values are DIY. So why can't you DIY all the way up? Turns out you can. I mean, technology's helped us do that. Our experience has helped us do that. But what's to stop? I mean, you could build it for yourself. I mean, you can build it from the inside out. And, you know, JT's yeah. just as kind of, he knows that inherently from his experience.
It took somebody like him, though. It needed to be JT. You know, I mean, like you said, since 04, this guy's been in it, doing it, killing it, album after album. You know, talk about staying relevant. They never stopped putting out music. You know, we never did either, but they never stopped having successful releases. Mm-hmm. And I really respect that. The longevity of that band, and, you know, even losing a member the way they did.
Casey, yeah.
We were on the second to last tour right before that happened. So, I mean, I was the closest with him in the band because he did partake of the booze. So, of course, whose bus do you think he was hanging out on all the time? mine, you know, because half of his band was straight edge. So I really missed that guy. I was lucky enough to take part in the memorial show in Orlando called Heavy and Light, which his widow attended. And it was just all tears all night long. And I felt honored to be there. And the whole show was just remembering Casey. And I've had so many good times with that guy. And to lose him was tough on me. So I just can't imagine, you know, what those guys, because they're a band of friends, man. They weren't like me. They weren't a revolving door. You know, they were solid, solid, tight group. And they were really, really close with one another. So to see them come back from that, and it needed to be somebody like JT, who has the scars, you know, who has the bullet holes and the knife wounds that have been sutured up. He needed to lead the way. And I'm glad it's him, and he deserves it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they've overcome a lot. They've been around a long time. And the longevity story, I mean, you know, every band that has that, you know, you have a peak or something, but that doesn't mean that, you know, but people will remember you from your peak, but sometimes not see that you stay in this quality thing and do it for 20 years, not have a peak, disappear, and do a reunion. There's something different about doing the reps year after year, maintaining the quality, improving your quality, growing your skill, getting your, you know, and sometimes those stories are quiet, and then sometimes they pay off in the long run, and I think you're a good example of that, and JT's a good example of that.
Well, thank you very much. I think I'm in good company with people like yourself and JT, and I think we're all good examples of that. I mean, I remember when you guys invited us out on your anniversary tour, it was packed every night, every single night. That was a hell of a tour. You know, I had a blast on that tour, and I was happy to see that many people there. I mean, it was from what I can recall, a 95% sellout ratio. We're talking about Emory here. So, I mean, and this is years, years later. The anniversary tour thing has been a really big help, I think. I mean, I'm sure you remember coming up. It never really was a thing. And then all of a sudden, it started becoming...
Bands didn't used to... It just used to not... You know, we're in the first waves of bands lasting and existing for decades. Like that, nobody right. thought that was a thing. It was just like, well, you might get three albums.
So here we are. We're doing it together. And that's one of the things about Is for Lovers that I was trying to explain earlier, that we all came up together. Mm-hmm. We're all part of this thing. So to be at a festival ran by one of us is what makes it so special.
Yeah, we all figured we might have put a couple records out and get to do something fun before we had to get a real job or go straight. Yeah. But maybe we don't.
Maybe we don't, man. You know what? If it hasn't happened by now, maybe it ain't gonna happen.
Right. Ronnie, thank you so much for, you know, really opening up and spending the time with me here. It both feels good and I think is, you know, great conversation. I really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you, man. I always love hanging out with you guys, and I hope this time around we get a little more personal time.
Yeah, I think we will. We got several shows to go the rest of the year, and, you know, there's plenty more to do and plenty more years to come, it seems like.
Sounds good, buddy.
So good luck to you guys. Is there anything? I know you guys have the Alliance, so we help people will join the Alliance. That's your email list and, you know, the modern version of what your street team would have been back in the day, I imagine.
Yeah. If you want to know all things jumpsuit, it's called the Alliance. That's just a loose term that we call our friends. Some people call them fans. We call them friends. It's just an email sign up. We promise not to spam you too bad, other than just telling you about cool new merch designs. That's basically it, or concert tickets. You can sign up for free at thebandname.com. That's the red jumpsuit apparatus.com. But more importantly than anything, I can tell you, if you're going to go to any festivals this year, check out an Is for Lovers Fest. I can promise you, not only are you going to see some of the best bands from the scene that you've ever seen, but you're going to see those bands having the best time of their life. And that's not something you get to see every day.
Awesome. And new music. I know you got a song that, you know, JT and you were already talking about, but you have people keep their ears open. You have something new coming out in June?
We do. We got some new songs, but you know, that's the thing is there's always a new song, you know? So to me, I'm not going to talk too much about it, but there's a new song called Purple Halo. I do believe it'll be out before some of these festivals. Make sure you check it out. I hope you like it. Doesn't really matter if you do though. You see what I'm saying? It doesn't really matter because it's not even about that. But we do got some new music coming out, so if you're into the current sound, make sure you check it out. Purple Halo coming soon.
Thank you, Ronnie.
Thank you, sir. Matt, it's always a pleasure.